Can we put it back?
Sorry, I can
just use this. So, I mean... Dude,
you're a baller like that, right? Hello. Alright, so... Does everyone have it downloaded? How's your PC exam? Yeah? Well, you get another shot on the final, so it's alright. Probably be a little bit easier. Anyway, so we have office hours on Monday, 4 to 5. If anybody like really wants to go and can't make that or has a like time conflict, just email me. And I'll probably be in the library anyway, so we could meet up. Jeff's on his way. He's going to go through part of the topics, and I'm going to do like the first half. Pretty much everything that we cover. There he is. Look at him. Dang. Woo! Yeah. hold on 1 second, actually. I want to make sure that you guys can see the whole screen. Okay. So we're going to go over a review of everything, and most of what we cover will probably be in some shape or form on the exam, so you can use our slides and feel safe that you're getting most of the material. Probably like 97, 98% of the material. So just use these slides. If you don't understand something, you can always just go back to the lecture. And, yeah. Kind of. Yeah. 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 So pay attention. Here we go. Okay, so the exam covers, obviously, lectures from 3:31 to 5:05. There's two lectures from each date. Focus on the objectives. If they're not posted on CLE, then I've said this before, it's kind of focus on the main slides. You know, if, for example, the cystic fibrosis lecture, you don't need to know the whole story about the girl, right? You need to know the class mutations. You need to know the main stuff. So extra stuff from the lectures you don't necessarily need to know for the exam. So just remember that. Yeah. It's not.
So it's all the way up to last week's stuff, so not the 23.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Cancel that.
All the way down to oncology stuff. So the green lectures from last week.
You'll see, like, Jeff will have it in his slides. Okay, so I'm going to go over some of this basic stuff a little bit more quickly, but this is just a quick little overview. You guys have seen this slide like probably 10 times now. You have a patient group, they have a certain diagnosis, and there's a bunch of different options that can happen. So you can give a drug that's toxic and that beneficial. You can give a drug that's toxic but not beneficial, so this is really bad, right? You can give a drug that's not toxic and beneficial, which is great, and you can give a drug that's not toxic and not beneficial, which would essentially be doing nothing. But just kind of keep this framework in your head when you answer the exam questions. And just to go back to the exam real quick, there's going to be 18 multiple choice questions, and there's going to be short answer questions as well. So I think the multiple choice is 2 points each, so it'll be 36 points, and the other remaining points will be on the multiple choice, or I mean the short answer. So 100, right? Yeah. All right, so the cytochrome P450 enzymes, these are the superfamily of enzymes. You guys know this really well from PC115, but know that the CYPs are the major enzymes involved in drug metabolism and bioactivation. Most CYPs catalyze the oxidation of organic substances. You guys have covered this in other classes too, but just again, a broad overview. This slide here just shows you the polymorphic distribution. So on the y-axis, we have the number of subjects, and on the x-axis, we have increasing metabolic capacity. So as you move to the right from poor metabolizer to ultra-rapid metabolizer, you're increasing the metabolic capacity. And so this next slide, we talk about codeine and morphine. So is codeine a prodrug or an active drug? Prodrug. So I told this to the people that are in my discussion section, but every question, especially the short answer that you get to that has a drug on there, the first thing you should do is figure out, is it a prodrug or an active drug? That's what I always do. And the second thing you need to figure out is the polymorphism, does it make it a poor metabolizer, an ultra metabolizer, does it have no effect? So those are like the main things you want to keep in mind. Because what's the difference? Can somebody tell me like the difference if you have a poor metabolizer of a poor drug or a pro drug versus an active drug? What's the difference? So, yeah, so a poor metabolizer, more accumulation, and then what's the difference between a pro drug and an active drug? So if you have an accumulation of an active drug, okay, and then if you have accumulation of a pro drug, then you're not going to see the effect, right? So always keep that in mind, and this graph just kind of shows you that. Okay, so she covered this in one of her lectures, the story about dabrysiquin. Ignore that title. It was for another slide I was going to have in there that the hint is about this. So let's ignore that. But the antihypertensive drug I'm referring to is dabrysiquin. So it's metabolized by CYP2D6. And the story about this goes, in 1970, St. Mary's Medical School in London, a small trial with dabrysiquin, a drug for treating high blood pressure. So the first thing you want to do is say, okay, what does this drug do? It treats high blood pressure. And then you want to ask yourself, is it an active drug or prodrug? So you probably have to keep reading. Because, you know, she's not going to just throw a random drug at you and expect you to know unless you guys have talked about it. But you should be able to kind of decipher and pull from the information given. So volunteers were healthy young medical students as well as the PI of the study. A small dose was given to each volunteer. Afterwards, one volunteer, the PI, suddenly collapsed because of a drastic fall in his blood pressure. So that sentence right there is really important, right? So what does that mean? Is this a prodrug or an active drug? Active, exactly. Because you know it's an antihypertensive. Right? And all of a sudden, he got really low blood pressure, meaning it's working really, really well. So let's read on. So later it was found that 10% of British population will have the same reaction as the PI. So you guys already answered this. It's an active drug. And how do you know from the info? Because we said it was an antihypertensive drug, and the little story said that the person collapsed because the blood pressure went too low. So you know that the drug is having too good of an effect, essentially, right? So it must be an active drug. And then we know it must be a poor metabolizer, right, because he has a buildup of the active drug. Does that make sense? Anyone have any questions about that?
So how would you tell the difference between, the active drug or a prodrug? Could you poor metabolizer in one, but ultra-rapid metabolizer in the other, and they could theoretically have the exact same effect, right?
So you're saying, like, in this case, let's say that, let's say instead of him falling over, it said that, like, everybody else's blood pressure went down except for his, or something like that. And you're like, I wonder what's going on. And that means that possibly that he's an ultra-rapid metabolizer, right? Because everybody else, let's assume they're extensive metabolizers. They're getting the active drug, it's working, but he's just clearing it really quickly. If he was an ultra-rapid metabolizer of the prodrug, then he would be the one seeing the effect, right? So, like, he would... Yeah, so you're saying that how do we know it's a prodrug and not an active drug? So, in this case, just because we know that it's an it's a drug treating hypertension, right, high blood pressure, and it says right here that once one volunteer suddenly collapsed due to his blood pressure. So you know that his blood pressure dropped, so it must be an active drug. Like, most of the drugs you guys cover will be active drugs, except for, like, a select few, so.
So, like you said, there's no chance that they'll throw something totally new because it's still not exactly that.
No. So, like, now that we're talking about this, you guys should memorize this drug, know it's an active drug, and, you know, what metabolizes it. Yeah. So if this was a prodrug, then, and he was a poor metabolizer, then he's going to have a buildup of the prodrug, which is an inactive drug, right? Now, depending on that specific drug, that could have no effect, or it could have some kind of toxic effect. We don't know specifically for the drug, but we do know that it's not going to reduce his blood pressure. Does that make sense? And then for question 3, which enzyme is responsible? It's CYP2D6. And that's also just from your lecture slides. You like that animation? All right, so these are the percentages of CYP2D6 frequency, like of polymorphisms in the population. And this is all posted, so you guys have the slides. Okay, so pretty much already just talked about this, but know that these can be caused by different types of variations, one of them being point mutations or alternative splicing for the poor metabolizer phenotype. And for the ultra-rapid metabolizer phenotype, pretty much the same thing except for now you're ultra-rapid. Okay, I'm going to skip this. All right, so single nucleotide polymorphisms. So you should be aware that 99.9% of our DNA is the same with one another, and that 0.1% is what makes the difference, which is approximately 3 million SNPs. And all of these in this image here are some things that can cause variation that could affect and lead to a disease or a change in a protein or something like that, which ultimately in certain situations will lead to like a disease manifestation. So deletion, insertion, inversion, copy number variant, and segmental duplication. I mentioned this last time that you don't need to necessarily know, like, for warfarin, like, what on what chromosome, like, what number, like, what's is a G going to an A, like, what's happening. You just need to know that all of these are essentially types of variations. So you don't need to, for the specific drugs, unless I don't think they've actually mentioned for any drug, like, a specific locus, like, what's going on. Just know that all of these are different types of variations. Okay, so she mentioned in one lecture idiosyncratic drug reactions versus pharmacology-related reactions. So an idiosyncratic drug reaction is essentially a drug, an adverse drug response, but not because of its known mechanism of action. And it's not dependent on the dosage of the drug. It can be a very small dose that causes something like this, and it's very unpredictable. So this is kind of scary because a lot of times as pharmacists, you start with a small dose and you titrate up. So essentially it's an adverse reaction that cannot be explained on the basis of the known mechanisms of action of the drug and occurs mostly unpredictably in susceptible individuals irrespective of dosage. And this is an important bullet point here. Idiosyncratic reactions account for 6 to 10% of all drug reactions, but they are a major source of morbidity and mortality. These are just some. So in the epileptic lecture, you guys talked about some of these drugs and some things that could. Some of these idiosyncratic drug reactions are immune-related hypersensitivity reactions. So mild erythematous or maculopapular rashes, life-threatening Stevens-Johnson syndrome, which you guys talked about, I think, quite in detail with Dr. Burchard, and you can also get liver toxicity. And even irreversible visual field constriction. Not that important, but. So, you guys should definitely read this article. It's the one about the Han Chinese from Taiwan where they figured out which allele associated with Stevens-Johnson syndrome induced by carbamazepine. So, I think it's really short, actually, only a couple pages. So, definitely read it. You can just find it by Googling this, essentially. And so what she really focused in lecture on when you're reading papers like this, like what you want to be thinking about, and she kind of has a list of questions here. So these are the kind of questions you want to have when you're approaching an article. What is the problem that the author set out to address, and what did they find? How do they design their study? How do they come to their findings? Are their findings credible? Why or why not? And what are the key take-home messages? So next year in study design, you guys will go into this a little bit more, but it's always good to just kind of be thinking about that when you're reading a paper. So specifically for this paper, I'm going to, you know, you guys can go home and read it, but I'm also going to kind of go into it in case you're being lazy. So they recruited 44 patients with carbamazepine-induced Stevens-Johnson syndrome, and then they had two sets of controls, and that's very important to have. So they had 101 patients, which were matched to the intervention group because they were also taking the drug, but they had no Stevens-Johnson syndrome. And they've been on it for at least 3 months without adverse reaction. And then they had 93 normal individuals, and these people didn't have, they weren't taking carbamazepine, they didn't have Stevens-Johnson syndrome, They were just there as a reference because this allows for the assessment of allele frequency in a general population. Also included in the study, everybody was Han Chinese from Taiwan. And that's important when you think about if the study is applicable to everybody or is it specific to that group. So those are things you kind of want to be thinking about. And obviously the study was approved by the IRB of that institution. So how did they design their study? Was it a GWAS, genome-wide association study, or was it a candidate approach? This specific one was a candidate approach, because they already had a hypothesis. So they wanted to look at the HLA gene and the cytochrome P450 gene because they believed that the metabolism and the immune response could be involved in the Stevens-Johnson syndrome being induced from the carbamazepine. So that was like their hypothesis, which is why they didn't do a genome-wide association study. Does that make sense? Do you guys have specific questions about that? So genome-wide association study, you're more looking at, let's say you have like two big populations, and I brought this example up last time too, but you're looking at a population with diabetes and without, and then you do genome-wide association study and you look for alleles that might be associated with the disease. And then you kind of like hone in on that and see if it's related. But here they already had a hypothesis. They already felt like these two genes were involved. So that's why they did a candidate approach gene study. And one of the previous workshop slides goes a little bit more into the difference between GWAS and candidate gene study. So for like, I can explain it a little bit better, but the genome-wide association study is like you don't know what allele could be causing a certain disease, right? So when you do a genome-wide association study, you're looking for outliers of possible alleles on certain chromosomes that could be causing the disease that you're interested in. But here they already had a hypothesis, so they didn't have to do that. I'm not sure. Do you know? Probably. Yeah.
Which is like they already have a good idea. So based on previous studies, they noticed that like, oh, this gene seems to be being related to this kind of side effect. So they already have something going in mind. So that's why it's kind of versus GWAS, which just start from scratch. So
yeah, that's a good way to put it. And GWAS is more like starting from scratch. Versus the candidate approach, you already have a hypothesis. So what is the problem to be addressed and what is the finding? Stevens-Johnson syndrome induced by carbamazepine, a commonly used anti-epileptic drug. They found a strong genetic association between HLA-B star 1502 and carbamazepine-induced Stevens-Johnson syndrome. They suggested that the association can be exploited in a highly reliable test to predict the adverse drug reaction. So how did they come to their findings? In the next slide, I'll explain this a little bit more. But essentially, they concluded that there was no significant association between any of the cytochrome P450 SNPs and the occurrence of carbamazepine-induced Stevens-Johnson syndrome, but they did have these alleles that were associated with increased frequency in patients with carbamazepine-induced Stevens-Johson syndrome. So how did they come to their findings? There was a slide where you guys talked about positive predictive value, negative predictive value, sensitivity, specificity. It's kind of confusing, so I'm going to go through like an example that's like a little bit more interactive so everybody knows how to do it. Sound good? All right, so just to review, positive predictive value is essentially you look at the people who have the disease and test positive for it. And I'm going to go a little bit more example in this, so just bear with me for a second. And you divide that by the total people who test positive. So somebody can test positive, and it could be a false positive, right? Because they don't have the disease. So that's why it's the people who have the disease who test positive by whatever diagnostic test or whatever you're using divided by the total people who test positive. The negative predictive value is the people who don't have the disease and test negative divided by the total people, or sorry, divided by the total who test negative. So like I mentioned before, let's say you have the disease or you don't have the disease and you test negative. But there's a possibility that you test negative, but you actually have the disease, right? So the test made a mistake. So that negative predictive value looks at that. The sensitivity are the people who have the disease and test positive, and this time it's divided by the total people who have the disease versus the total people who test positive, like in the positive predictive value. And it sounds like a lot of words and stuff, but when I go over the next slide, it'll make a little bit more sense. I'm just kind of reading off the definitions. For specificity, it's the people who don't have the disease and they tested negative over all the people who don't have the disease. So when I say, like, don't have the disease and test negative, I'm just going to explain that one more time. Like, you could, let's say, like, I'm pregnant or something, whatever. Somebody's pregnant and they take a pregnancy test and it says that they're not pregnant. Right? But they're actually pregnant, so the test was wrong. That makes sense? So, I'm going to go over that. Okay, so specifically to that paper that we were talking about, so they had 44 people who had the disease, in this case being the Stevens-Johnson syndrome induced by the drug, and they tested positive for those specific alleles, like the HLA star 1502, right? So they tested positive and they had the disease, and there was nobody who tested negative and had the disease. So that tells you right there that there's a strong association, right, with testing positive and having the disease. In this example, it's always good to kind of make a 2x2 table like this. So here you're going to put the disease or an example of like a pregnancy. If, you know, it's not a disease, obviously, you would put the whatever you're looking at up here, and then down here you would put the test. Yeah. Yeah. So, let's explain it one more time, is that this first one right here, disease positive, means that they had Stevens-Johnson syndrome induced by the drug. And then tested positive means that they had the allele. And so, just looking at these numbers down here, the positive predictive value, you take the 44, which is the people who tested positive and have the disease, and you divide it by 47, and that's the total who test positive, right? So these three people right here, they tested positive, but they didn't have the disease. That means they had that allele, but for some reason they didn't get Stevens-Johnson syndrome.
So are those people up there
you look at when they're trying to learn how to compare some things? You mean
in the comparison?
I think that's a really good question. I'm sure there's hypotheses around that, like why they have the allele. But a lot of times it's not just one allele, right? There's a lot of other things going on. But, I mean, if you get a really strong association like this, you can probably say that a lot of it has to do with that allele. Do you know, Jeff, any other? I mean, yeah. So I think, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Or, I mean, the test could have just been wrong. Maybe they do, and the test just didn't detect it. Because not all the tests are perfect, right? So that's one of the issues we have with, like, genetic testing, is that a test isn't perfect, right? It's not always going to know exactly if you have the mutation or not. They're pretty good at being fairly accurate, but they're not perfect. So that's why we do this. Okay, so then down here, for the negative predictive value, we're looking at, so we did this row first, and then now we're going to do this row. So how many people have the disease and test negative? We said zero. How many people don't have the disease and also test negative? So that's correct in a sense, right? If you think about it that way, like you don't have the disease, and the test is telling you you don't have the disease. So to find the negative predictive value, you take the number of people who don't have the disease, and the test accurately reflects that, and you divide it by all the people who tested negative. So if this number had been like 2, for example, this 0, then it would be 98 over 100. So this row is being summed up this way. This row is being summed up this way. Okay, and the specificity and sensitivity is essentially the same thing going the other way, and you could look back at the definitions. I'm going to go through that example because I think it will make a little bit more sense. So the blue background and all that. But so this is a practice example. So that's what I actually ended up choosing, was pregnancy is like the outcome, I guess, or like what we're looking at. And so being pregnant, positive pregnancy, not pregnant, And this is the test, right? This is the test that you can buy that detects HCG. So let's say we have 75 people who are pregnant, and the test says that they're pregnant. So that's correct, right? And that's, we know that they're pregnant, and the test says, yes, you have high levels of HCG, which is associated with, like, early pregnancy. But there's 40 people who are pregnant, but the test says that they're not. So the test is wrong, right? So I just made up this example, so this is not, like, a real example. So let's start with the first one. If we were going to do the positive predictive value, does anybody want to, like, shout out what they think it's going to be?
75
over 90. Nice. Okay. For the negative predictive value, so let me just go through this one. Does this make sense? I feel like I'm talking too much about this, but I feel like it can get kind of confusing on the exam. So that's why I'm going, like, fairly slow over this. So this side over here, we have people who aren't pregnant, and the test says they are, right? So that's a false positive, because the test is like, you're pregnant, but they're actually in real life, they're not. And over here, you have the people who are not pregnant, and the test says that they're not pregnant. So that's good, right? That's correct. So jumping to the negative predictive value, here would be 105 over 145. So all the people who are not pregnant and the test says they're not, divided by all the tests that came out negative. And then for the sensitivity and specificity, you guys could do this one at home, I guess, but you just essentially do the same thing in the other way. So you have 75 over 115, and you have 105 over 128. Does anyone have any questions about that? So there might be a problem where they have you, you know, make a 2x2 table, or you probably have to make a 2x2 table to figure out the positive predictive value, the negative predictive value, the sensitivity, and the specificity. So despite the fact that I showed this example, I still highly recommend you guys read that article, because all this data is in that article, and you can see exactly what their methods were and follow that along. I highly suggest you do that. Okay, so the take-home points of this paper, I'm going to skip this just straight from your slides. This led to labeling being issued by the FDA, and so the study had, like, a huge impact. Okay, so jumping to the Manhattan plot, this is one of the graphs that were covered in your lecture. And so this is essentially a scatter plot, and it displays data, large number of data points, like we talked about. So this is kind of like what kind of graph you would see in a GWAS, in a genome-wide association study. So chromosomes, this is the negative log P, and this P is for the significance, right? The p-value? Yeah. Which ones? Yeah, I mean, so just based off of these, like, definitions, you should know how to calculate it, but you should also understand what this means, right? Like, for example, looking at this example from the paper, so 98 people tested negative, right? And 98 people who didn't have the disease tested negative, and here you have 44 people who had the disease and tested positive. So there was nobody who had the disease but tested negative, right? So that's really good. That means the sensitivity of this test is 100%. So you want a sensitivity that's higher. That's it. Yeah. Essentially, this is if you go from here to here, you're looking at positive predictive value, negative predictive value, you know, sensitivity, specificity. So just, you should make a 2x2 table, but understand that, you know, a higher sensitivity, for example, in this case. So this is like these are really great findings, right? I don't think very often you see that kind of sensitivity in real, like, in other studies. So, okay. What you should know about the Manhattan plot, essentially, is that the highest point is the most significant. And so looking at this, like, if we were talking about, like, diabetes earlier, they would say, oh, okay, this allele here on chromosome 19 seems to have some kind of association with the group that has diabetes. So maybe there's some kind of relationship there. And they hone in on it, like Jeff was saying, and they do more studies and try to figure out if that's actually true. Okay. Last couple slides, just really quickly. Linkage, essentially, is pretty simple. It just refers to residing of genes on the same chromosome. So she talked about in lecture how there's a student sitting in rows. They're essentially, like, linked by the fact that the seats are together. So that's, like, linkage. And recombination breaks linkage. And recombination is crossover, like you learned from, like, meiosis and stuff like that. Or it could be, you know, like a SNP. Haplotype, so essentially a block of linked alleles. And she also used another example with the classroom. She said six friends sitting next to each other in the first row are considered a haplotype. So if you think about each person being like a certain allele, they're together considered a haplotype. And they tend to travel together and they're linked. So these are just some basic definitions you should know for the exam.
What's the difference
between linkage and haplotype? Linkage is just like the broader term for the fact that there are a bunch of alleles residing on the same gene or the same chromosome. Whereas haplotype is like a group of them, and they tend to travel together, and they're considered a haplotype in that sense. So by travel together, meaning like they tend to be inherited, right, from like our ancestry down each generation. She went over this example. So up here, she showed like a haplotype, an original haplotype from our like great-great ancestors, and you have some kind of mutation. So like, for example, in this one, you see that the C1 becomes the C2. So now this is a new haplotype. And down here, you have haplotype 2. And in this one, I think what changed is the A1 became an A2. So those are, these simple mutations could cause a change in haplotype. Also, however, you can have a change in haplotype from recombination. So you should just be able to know what kind of things could cause new haplotypes. Yeah, until there's some kind of recombination event or something like that that breaks the haplotype. So this original haplotype is like broken now, right? Because there was some kind of variation that formed this new one. So, does that answer your question?
Yeah. Right.
Okay, and then linkage disequilibrium. So, this is kind of like a weird concept, but I think it sounds really complicated, but it's really not. Essentially, it's just what it says right here. So, if you were to look at B1, and I asked you what has a higher probability let's look at C1. Let's just go off this bullet point here. So B1 has a higher probability than A1 to associate with C1. So essentially, the genes that are closer to each other have a higher likelihood of associating with each other. So a linkage disequilibrium is a measure of this association. Yeah. So I think there was another, I think she has in her slide she actually shows you like the arrows. I don't know, it didn't copy into mine, of the recombination. But you should be aware how new haplotypes come about. So different types of mutations and recombination, which recombination is like the same thing as crossover from your undergrad days. Okay, that's it for my part, and Jeff's going to take over. And again, having office hours Monday, 4 to 5, in the library. So swing by if you have any questions. Thank you.
do you have to do this computer for lecture capture or for lecture capture? I'm not sure. Yeah. Wait, it's on the. I guess it's on the. Oh, actually.
All right, everybody. Well, thanks for coming for the review session. And thanks, Daga, for just kind of, I think Daga did the hard part going over all the like science of pharmacogenomics. I posted all the slides on the, did y'all find it? Yeah, okay. All right, cool. Let's just cruise through this. It's your last exam, so let's everybody, let's be happy after the exam, okay? So let's pay close attention so that we can, make sure everybody does well. So part two, barriers to pharmacogenetics, it's pretty straightforward stuff, right? A lot of cash involved, and it requires, I think the first one's actually pretty interesting, that I thought was pretty interesting, it requires a lot of, follow-up. So just because you have, a pharmacogenomic test, and that's, it's really awesome. But, it leads to more complications sometimes because, now that you know that this test is so awesome, you have to, have to consider, so when do we follow up with this patient? Or, what happens if, something goes wrong with this patient due to this, genotype? So, it's kind of like when you know more, you kind of go into that wormhole. For this exam, don't think too hard, okay? Don't think and go into the wormhole, all right? And pharmacogenetics is a very new concept, so a lot of physicians and pharmacists might not be adopting that, especially if they were very traditional with their methods. And sometimes we tend to overstate the benefits, this is awesome, but in a lot of cases, at this point, for example, GWAS studies, I'll show you the graph later, but we're still lacking a lot of evidence for really those rare alleles. Or really significant alleles. So at this point, we're still in the very early stages. So I think this is a very important concept too. Make sure you know how to write this down and stuff. So when is genetic testing appropriate and when it's not? Okay. So genetic testing. If it's cheap, obviously it's good. And especially if this side effect or outcome is very popular, then it's probably worth testing for. If the test is very reliable, then it's definitely worth a shot doing pharmacogenomic testing. And especially, for example, if the best treatment is ambiguous, for example, then it might be good to have a confirmation with the pharmacogenomic testing. And also, so kind of opposite of what cheap testing is. Like, if the cost of incorrect treatment is high, so, like, make sure you know these wordings, okay? Like, just don't get tricked by the words. Like, if the cost of the incorrect treatment is high, then that's when pharmacogenomic testing would be viable, right? All right, so just know that. And in contrast, when would you not do a test? If it's expensive, it's basically the opposite stuff, right? There's very little cost to suboptimal treatment. And the test itself, is if it's not like likely to help, like if it has poor performance, if there's already a really good treatment out there, then maybe pharmacogenomic testing just might be a waste of time. And if there's no any alternative, then why bother doing testing, right? So make sure you know like when and when not to use pharmacogenomic testing. Remember like Dr. Galanter's class, like we kind of raised our hands for like, do you think clopidogrel should be tested or not, like those examples. So there's not like a right or wrong answer, like, oh, this answer is like this, right? Like make sure you know how to like, if you say this testing is not worth it, then like, well, we want to make sure you all like write down like what like your supporting causes are, okay? So like, if you go with one direction, make sure you support the clause, okay? All right. Any questions so far? No? Good. All right, so now let's kind of move on to epilepsy, the two lectures of epilepsy. So I think in general, like epilepsy, you'll learn it in like therapeutics like next year, but epilepsy, there's two types. So there's the like general tonic-clonic seizures, and then there's the partial seizures. But I think in this class, the lectures went over like a lot of the types of epilepsy, but let's only focus on the general tonic-clonic, so the monogenic epilepsy. And there's two types, like the channels and then the non-channels. But let's only focus on the voltage-gated channels, okay? So that's what you need to focus. There's many types of epilepsy, but let's focus on the monogenic voltage-gated sodium channel epilepsy, all right? That'll probably save a lot of time for everybody. So talking about epilepsy, like the last three points here are very important. So just know that like there's, do y'all kind of know what epilepsy is, like seizure? Kind of just go crazy, right? Like it's like a neurological disorder. Sometimes it can be like very idiosyncratic, but in many times it's very like highly associated with like the voltage channels. And I'll kind of go over that later because I think that's very important to know. But just know some of the like characteristics. Like it comes in many phenotypes, and it can be either genetic, but also it can be like very hereditary, acquired, like later, that can be totally non-genetic. And as of now, we have not only the drugs, but we also have surgery options, vagal nerve stimulations, all these things. Just know these. So I think amongst the many like types of like seizures, I think they primarily focused on the Dravet syndrome. So the Dravet syndrome is like one of the most severe types of seizures, and it kind of leads to like fatalities. So initially you start from like a very, like just like a febrile seizure, but then you develop this into a Dravet syndrome. So that's kind of like the most, I guess, last stage of, you know, being a very severe seizure. And this is a type of a generalized tonic-clonic seizure. And everybody, make sure you know this, okay? So NAV 1.1, I emphasize this in my workshop, but make sure everybody knows it's not NAV 1.2, it's NAV 1.1, okay? So NAV 1.1 mutation is responsible for Dravet syndrome. So how this kind of works is, I'll kind of go over the pathophysiology. So normally, like, how seizures occur is, like, especially we're talking about the voltage-gated, right? So for voltage-gated here, normally what happens in seizure is, like, these sodium channels are way too active. So, like, when these sodium channels are very active, then a lot of the ions come in, and then you all learned about action potential, right? Like in general biology, like the action potential. So having too much sodium come in, like it generates this crazy action potential like so many times, and that's when like people kind of get those seizures. And what a normal person's NAV 1.1, so everybody has NAV 1.1, but a normal person's NAV 1.1 kind of functions like as an inhibitor. So it binds to the GABA neurons, and did you all learn about GABA neurons? Like GABA, it's like an inhibitory neuron. Like alcohol binds to GABA as well. That's why like if you drink a lot of shots, then you knock out. That's because it's inhibitory. So same as how alcohol works NaV1.1 for a normal person binds to the GABA, and GABA is inhibitory, so it makes sure that the person is calming down so that we don't get these seizures. But like, if you have a mutation or a defect in NaV1.1, then these channels start going crazy, right? You're, like, they're no longer, you know, calming down, and then that's how you get those seizures. So a person with a mutated NaV1.1 would have these types of seizures. And so that's kind of how carbamazepine works. So carbamazepine was one of the many drugs that used, that was listed on the slides, but no carbamazepine, okay? So carbamazepine, how it works is it kind of stabilizes the inactivated sodium channels. So by inactivated, it means like, you know, like the calm channels, basically, like the ones that are inactive and like not working. So it makes sure that these sodium channels don't go too crazy, and that's how carbamazepine is one of the drug of choices for seizures. So like it kind of acts right here, makes sure that the sodium channels are inactivated, and that's how carbamazepine works. And as Dagger talked about, SJS, Steven Johnson, is a very deadly side effect, and it's associated with HLA-B star 1502, right? Yeah, 1502, all right? Question? Can you say that again?
Is NaV1.1 the gene that expresses
GABA? Yeah, I mean, I think you don't have to know like the exact physiology, but it's I think it binds to the GABA, right? That's from my understanding, but so it binds to the GABA, which is, you know, normally doing it. Yeah, so that's why it's functioning as like an inhibitory interneuron. So yeah, it's inhibitory. Okay, it's not excitatory, inhibitory. Any other questions? Good so far? So yeah, this is kind of what you need to know for epilepsy. Okay, question?
So
Steven Johnson syndrome, like your whole skin gets messed up and stuff like that. Yeah. So. Oh, so this is all related to epilepsy.
I know you're asking. So the HLA-B1502 is the mutated allele, right?
Yeah.
That's the one that, like, let's say there was like some kind of variation, and now you have that gene versus the normal one, and then you have carbamazepine, then you're likely to get Steven Johnson. So the NaV1 isn't directly associated with.
Yeah.
So now this is for the Dravet syndrome, and then now we're talking about the drug here, like about carbamazepine. I just wrote two.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Good so far. All right. Let's move on. So for TPMT, TPMT, similar to like CYP enzymes, it's one of the most prominent enzymes. Not as prominent as CYP, of course. But you'll learn a lot later on in Dr. Longbow's lecture about TPMT. And TPMT does affect a lot of drugs. In this case, we learned about 6-mercaptopurine, right? It's used for cancer drugs. And so the important concept here is like normally 6-mercaptopurine, it goes through 3 metabolizing pathways. So it goes to the 6-MEMP here. Then it goes to CMP here, and then also the 6TU. So what would happen if a patient has a TPMT deficiency? Can somebody kind of tell me what might happen? Exactly, great. So yeah, so if this side is blocked here, then more will go to the other two pathways, right? And we don't particularly care about the 6TU because it's inactive. So we would be more concerned about these here. And I think in a lecture, they emphasize how the 6-TGN, this is responsible for bone marrow suppression, and that's actually one of the dose-limiting toxicities of 6-MP. So when patients take this, like they can take it up to the point where they get bone marrow suppression, where like their white cells decrease, their neutrophils decrease, and like so their blood panel gets like not good, and that's when they have to stop the drug. Any questions? So make sure you know this, all right?
Bone marrow suppression happens when there's overdose 16
Exactly. So normally, just think of it as normal person. Like one third would go here, one third would go here, and one third would go this way. But like now, like basically because this is deficient, a lot of it is going to the other two pathways. Clear? So if you take the 6-MP drug, so if 6-MP is a drug, right? So if you take the 6-MP drug, then normally it gets metabolized into these pathways. But like having a deficiency in the TPMT, the enzyme in particular, will make it go through the other metabolic pathways.
So people who have that deficiency should not take that drug?
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah. So if you have a TPMT deficiency, then they either have to avoid it or they probably have to adjust the dose. All right, good. Okay, let's briefly go over allele frequency. So, let's see if this works. Should be quick. So, okay, I think I can. I was just gonna write here, but I guess you guys can kind of go over it. But so if we have a population of 100 people, and let's say that 10 people have the homozygous large A, and then 60 people have the heterozygous, and then 30 people are recessive AAs, so small A's. Let's think of how to calculate the allele frequency. So can somebody kind of help me calculate the allele frequency for the large A? Can somebody kind of go through that process? Should be pretty quick. All right, yeah, want to go for it?
So, I'm probably wrong, but there's 10 people, so you have 20.
So, for allele frequency?
Yeah.
So, okay, 20 people, all right. Yeah, all right.
And for the heterozygous, you have 30.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a total of 50 so far.
Mm-hmm.
Of big A. And then you divide that by
Because I think, actually, because I was going to do it on this. There, but,
and then you divide that by 100.
Yeah, so 200. Or you can just do 10 people have AA, right? So let's say that just think of the AA, there's 10 people with the AA, and then there's only one big A in the 60 people, right? So you can just divide that by 2. So that's 30. And then you just divide that by 100 as well. That would work as well, right? So what would the answer for this one be? If we ask, what is the allele frequency for the large A? 40%? Yeah, 40%. Yeah, I'll for the podcast purposes, but I can go over this at the very end in the board as well. So, yeah. All right. But make sure you know how to know this. I'll go over it after. All right. So then let's move on to the personalized medicine stuff. So there's two types of. So I think for this lecture there was two types of basically themes here. So there's either the empiric medicine, which is kind of the traditional type, the typical, we just kind of treat them based on, looking at their, anatomy and histology. And then it's a very trial and error, right? Trial and error. So it's, you just try something, and if it doesn't work, then you go on to the next second-line treatment, right? And that leads to high treatment failure. And that's why a lot of, new types of, dosing and, dosing strategies and drug discovery is leading towards sequencing guided medicine, and that's kind of what the main theme of the lecture was, right? So we're trying to move on to more genetic sequencing, and instead of looking at the patient's disease state, they actually look at the molecular profile, the actual what is happening really with the interaction of this disease, and how can we target that, and not only are we looking at next the next generation sequencing, just kind of know that it's like a next generation sequencing thing. It's like a new technique that we've been adopting. But a lot of the, kind of like what Dava showed on the very first slide, like individual therapy, like that's like the kind of overarching goal for sequencing guided medicine. All right, so they're very two different concepts, so empiric medicine versus sequencing guided medicine. So know the differences, okay? Know the difference between like what is empiric and what is sequencing guided medicine. And all right, now let's move on to GWAS studies and non-GWAS studies. So as we, I think Dalga briefly mentioned it, like GWAS. So you're basically, there's two, like when you approach a problem like for genetic sequencing, like you always go into that question, like should we do this in a GWAS or should we just do like a non-GWAS study? So let's start with GWAS. So GWAS is like, for example, if they're gonna, like if we're trying to see like what's going on, like for example, for me, like if I have like asthma, for example, then they would sequence me from top to bottom, basically, and then compare it to like a healthy person that does not have asthma, and then they'll see the differences. Like, so it's a very like unbiased. It's not biased because like you're just basically starting from zero all the way to like your whole genome. So it's a very unbiased approach. But what would be the downsides of GWAS? It's very expensive, all right, and it's very time consuming, right? So in a lot of cases, like the Han Chinese, for example, too, right? They went to a more like non-GWAS approach, right? So I think in a big picture, there's two types of non-GWAS approaches. There's the family studies. This is probably the most, you know, I guess traditional way, right? So if I have asthma, for example, we would genotype my family, like my mother, my father, and my sister, for example, because that's like probably the most likely cause, like, you know, hereditary reasons, right? So that's one way of doing it. And the second one is a candida gene analysis, so the Han Chinese example. For example, like let's say that for asthma, gene A and gene B are associated, then we would only focus on the gene A and gene B. So you don't have to look at the all the way up, like from zero to scratch, like a GWAS. You're only looking at those two, so once you find those mutations, you can stop. So that's why candida gene approach is much more quicker, but maybe it might be a little biased, right? Because I'm like, I'll be focusing on looking at gene A and gene B, right? So you might not really come up with like new, like you might be missing out on some genes, right? So it's kind of like a trade-off, right? So just make sure you know kind of like the difference between GWAS, non-GWAS, like when would you maybe use one over the other, all right? Questions? Good? All right, so GWAS is a very large study, 100,000 or more, right? So make sure you know the number, all right? 100,000. It's not 200,000. It's not like 10,000, right? It's 100,000 or more, right? And so it's a very high throughput screen. You're just genotyping basically everything. And as Dalga talked about, linkage disequilibrium. So this is like one way of reducing the burden. So I gave an example to my workshop, but like for example, since right now I'm like an Asian, Asians usually come with black hair and black eyes, right? So if you don't want to do like all, like if you're trying to genotype me like all the black hair stuff and the black eye stuff, then it might take a long time, right? So they might associate like, okay, this Jeffrey Kim has like he's an Asian, so he probably has like black eyes with black hair, so we'll just do the black hair and assume like black eye stuff is like, you know, follows along. So that kind of saves a little bit of the burden, right? So you kind of tie things together, like in the haplotype, right? So that kind of reduces the burden a little bit, but still GWAS is overall a much more costly experiment.
So that's when you use SNPs, when you associate things like that?
Yeah, so that's what we call it. Yeah, exactly, a tag SNP. So you kind of look at certain types of mutations. So if everything is like similar, but then like this one thing is different. So for example, if I'm an Asian and like my friend is Asian, we both have black eyes and black hair, but like I'm a little taller than like my friend, then that's where the SNP is, right? The height is different, right? So like we just have to focus on the height when we do the GWAS. That's like the SNP, right? Like the one thing that makes it different. So that saves a lot of the time. You don't have to go through every sequencing.
Okay, so we're saying it's 100,000 or more genetic markers.
Yeah, so that's kind of utilizing linkages like we were doing. You're like pairing it up in groups so that you can save a little bit of the burden. Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. All right, good so far. And just know the two platforms, Affymetrics and Illumina. All right, know those two. Yeah. So we told you, so don't, on the exam, if it shows up, don't be like, what the heck is this, all right? It's, so Affymetrics and Illumina are what we use for GWAS, all right? All right, so this graph, I think, was fairly important to understand. So this is from a Nature paper. I think it was on your slides as well. So the current problem with GWAS studies is it's only focusing on this white portion right here, the rare variants of small effects. So, for example, if this is the x-axis here is like basically the population, and the y-axis here is like the severity. So if it was like, you know, asthma, for example, the current GWAS studies are only able to really capture like the really, like, you know, not that severe asthmas, and, you know, only like one out of like 10,000 people have it. So it's not really worth doing a GWAS, right? What really GWAS is trying to do is like, and we have this amazing GWAS technique, but like, what we really want to focus on are the ones right here between these borders. So, for example, like, it's a very mild asthma, but if, like, you know, 10 out of, like, 20 people have, like, if half the people have this kind of asthma, then it might be worth studying for it, right? Or in contrast, like, even if it's, like, a very rare, like, only 1 out of 1,000 people have it, like, let's say that this asthma is, like, so severe, like, maybe you get really, really sick from it. Then it might be worth, you know, GWASing, right? So this is kind of like the target of what GWAS really aims to do. But at this current state, we're lacking the technology, and we're only able to capture this part. So this circle right here, the common variants implicated in common GWAS. So make sure you know this circle right here. All right? Yeah. So this, but like all three of these are good targets for GWAS. So when you kind of decide, like, GWAS versus non-GWAS, like, if it fits in this category, then it might be a good one to do. All right?
Which circle did you say you
want to focus on? I'm sure you all noticed, like, throughout my slides, I have these stars. Yeah. It's pretty, like, low-key, but, like, yeah. The stars are very important. Yeah. Right? Yeah.
So the three between the dotted line, that's
what
GWAS
is? One, two, and three. So this one, this... So for podcast people, the blue, the ones between the borders, like the rare allele causing Mendelian disease, low frequency variants, and then the one next to the star, yeah, yeah. All right. Okay, now let's move on to cystic fibrosis. So cystic fibrosis, basically, you don't have to know like all the pathophysiology, the exact details. But I'll just go through some of the basics so that it might help you with the exam. All right, so cystic fibrosis, this is also going to come up later in therapeutics as well, but it's a disease that basically, so normally we have these CFTR, so these are like the receptor, these channels. We have these throughout our lungs and our like GI system, and they provide these nice secretions, like mucus, so that, you know, we can... like breathe better and like our food can flow better. But like patients that have this cystic fibrosis, they have some form of mutation. Like we learned class 1 through 5, right? They have these kind of mutations that are making it so that, you know, they're not getting that nice gastric juice or like mucus so that they can breathe. So like usually they get very thick mucus, like they have a very hard time breathing, and that's kind of like the pathophysiology of cystic fibrosis. And it's all related to those class mutations that we talked about. So, because normally, like, Cl and sodium go in, and, like, as you all know, like, from osmosis, like, water comes in as well. And that's how you make this really nice, juicy, I guess, like, lung, right? But then you don't get that for cystic fibrosis patients because the channel is, you know, messed up. All right? That's kind of as much as you should know for the pathophysiology. And so just kind of like a basic, I think this, you don't have to know all the diagram of like the whole, like, for how is it made, but like just to kind of get a basic, We all learn from, like, you know, biology, right? Everybody, you know, passed biology to get into pharmacy school. But, like, DNA to RNA to protein, the central dogma, right? That's how the protein, in this case, the receptor, the channel is made, right? So you start from the very low level of DNA, well, all the way down, you start from the chromosome. You go to DNA, then you go to RNA, and then you go to protein, right? And throughout this process, there are several mutations that are involved. Class 2 mutations, I recommend you to study the class 2 mutations. So class 2, can somebody tell me what the class 2 mutations are? Misfolded proteins, all right, so great. So let's say that the protein is, so it looks like in this diagram, the protein is made in number 5, right? So the protein is made, but then like the folding causes a lot of like the problems. And I have a summary of all the class mutations here. But so I recommend kind of going through, knowing like class 1 through 5, and focus on class 2. I mean, still know 1 through 5, I think it'll be very important. But like just kind of read through it. Like, as you may know, like class 3 is a gating defect. So for example, we learned about the sodium and chloride and the water coming in, right? But like in this case, for the gating defect in class 3, it doesn't allow the channels to open. So if it doesn't open, then it's not functioning properly and water can't come in and the mucus can't come in for the patients to have that nice, juicy lung, right? And for class 2 mutation, one of the students mentioned, the protein folding and trafficking is what's the problem, right? So in this picture, the protein is made, but it's not going all the way here to the surface. Like, think of it as like a traffic, like a car traffic. You're not able to go on time, right? So it's not being delivered all the way to the surface properly. All right, so Evacaftor, that's like the one drug that we learned, right? So know this drug. So can Evacaftor be used for like all types of cystic fibrosis? No? Yes? No. No, right? So Evacaftor is specifically for one mutation, G551D. What's the most common mutation across, like, you know, the United States? The most common? Yep, can you say that again? Yep, Delta. So Del F508. Everybody got that? Del F508, the most common mutation. So would Evacaftor work on Del F508? No. All right. Evacaftor mainly focuses on like the gating mutations, like the salt and water movement. So it would be more for a class 3 mutation, right? We just talked about it, right? Class 3 mutation is a gating defect. Evacaftor helps movement of salt and water, so it's more suitable for a class 3 mutation. So if we had like a class 2 mutation, I think there was many drugs out there, but this is kind of like it sounds like a robot, but it's like a compound name. But this works as for the trafficking problems. So just kind of, I guess, maybe know the name. If like a patient has like a class 2 mutation, then maybe giving a drug like this might help with like the trafficking and the protein misfolding, okay? Any questions on cystic fibrosis? That's pretty much it for cystic fibrosis. Have a mutation in F508?
Yeah, because a lot of saying people who are homozygous for mutation can use this drug, so I'm just wondering if people who are heterozygous for mutation.
I mean, that's a good question. This is like, I just got this from the slides. I think this is still a very, it's right now it's doing phase 3 trials, so they're probably just, phase 3 is where they do the efficacy profile, right? So phase 2 is safety. So I'm assuming they're trying it on, you know, different indications. It seems like the indication here is for homozygous, but you don't have to know, like, the details. Just know, like, this drug might be, you know, be effective in these trafficking problems like class 2. All right? Good? All right, health policy. I'm not really good at health policy, but know these. All right? So for multi-gene panels. So I think the health policy lecture, she kind of talked about like kind of how like sometimes it's really hard to really implement, like even though genetic testing is great, like and like they found like something really awesome, like actually implementing it has like a lot of, you know, policy issues like insurance, you know, like economic benefits, like societal costs like that, right? So I think these three are kind of important to know. So these are like kind of issues of like, you know, why there might be some like challenges in implementing. So first of all, long-term prevalence and impact on costs and outcomes. So that's kind of like, as we said before, like a lot of studies, they're still like on their early phases. So like for these insurance companies and like these policies to work, they might want to like, they might be like, oh, like, do you guys have like long-term data? And then the companies might be like, oh, we're not really, we're still going studies, right? So that's one challenge. And the second one is can't just conduct a standard economic analysis of testing versus no testing because there's so many like different pathways involved, like different, you know, outcomes, like, and also finally there's a lot of like, you know, non-monetary. So even if like, you know, policy and like pharmacoeconomics deals with money, you should also kind of know like, does this test, you know, cause like anxiety to families? Like families, after knowing like, oh, Jeffrey's gonna, you know, die in two weeks, like my family's gonna be like super stressed, right? That's like a additional cost that is not monetary, right? So like those kind of things. Or like sometimes in a good way, like they might utilize this data, right? And that might not be incorporated into cost as well, right? So those are just some challenges, all right? So just know this. Yeah, stars. All right, and finally, this was the oncology lecture, but like there's nothing related to oncology. So for the oncology lecture, I think the oncology was just one example of like how like these assays should be developed. She talked kind of a lot throughout like this graph, right? This overall picture. Like you start from like, you know, thinking of like what kind of, you know, assay should we make. Then you have to go through a lot of like steps, right? Like components towards, you know, making a really good assay. And by assay we mean like, you know, testing, you know. So focus on the stars, right? So to develop a diagnostic assay, I thought these four are very important, and it should be important to you guys too. All right, so these four. So first, you have to, you know, analytically validate. You know, looking at, it has to be a very accurate test. It has to be very reliable. It has to be very reproducible, right? Like, if you do it constant, you know, times, it has to, you know, make sure you produce the right results, the same results, right? It has to, you know, be clinically validated, and it also has to have some good utility clinically. Like, and finally, here, I think the lecture slide said commercialized. I kind of like the word, like, more like public health perspective. But, like, you want to also make sure that your test eventually can overall improve, like, the economics and stuff. So I know this is, like, you know, all not really, like the science-y stuff, but I think it's on the exam. So, yeah, it's worth studying for. Yeah, all right. So that pretty much concludes my part. Anybody have any questions, like me and Daga stuff or exam in general? Good? Yeah, sure. We'll go over that. I'll go over that after the I end the podcast, but yeah. Anything else? No? All right, thank you. Let's ace the exam. How do I save the cap lecture podcast? Pause, I guess.